Hello, beautiful. And what I'd really like to know is what's good in your life today? I'm Kia, and this is another episode of the Female Veterans Podcast. Today, I have with me such an amazing, amazing woman. Detrell is an Army veteran. She served during my time, Desert Storm. So we have that in common, 8 years, just like me. And she is the founder of United in Sisterhood, an organization that works with female veterans. So you know we are aligned in our mission of serving our sisters, which is why this interview had to happen. So with that, I want to say welcome, Detrell.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a blessing to be here with you.
I absolutely feel blessed. And with that, I'm going to jump right into it. What made you join the military?
Actually, my father used to build airplanes, model airplanes. Wow. when I was a little girl. He always wanted to join the Air Force, but he had a heart condition, so he didn't qualify. He was murdered at the age of 33, and I was 9 years old at that time. But I knew that when I graduated from high school, I wanted to go into the Army. I really wanted to go and be active, but my mother wanted me to go to college. So I did the right thing and I went into the reserve. And that's how I found my way into the Army. He wanted the Air Force, but I wanted the Army because I like camping and I love being outdoors.
Well, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. So what was boot camp like for you?
Oh, boot camp was, it was so difficult, but it was a challenge that I needed. And I loved it. I love being challenged. I love being told that there are things that I cannot do. And I came out so much braver, stronger, and confident in myself because I did not think I could do the things that I did. I did not think I could accomplish those 8 weeks, but I did it. And it was fascinating.
What was the biggest challenge?
I think the biggest challenge was the physical stuff. You know, I wasn't and I'm still not a morning person. So being awakened in the morning, I did my boot camp in Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And I still remember my drill sergeant Barksdale. He woke us up banging on metal trash cans all throughout the barracks. But being forced to go out at like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning in the dark, we had to do our physical stuff on, they called it Camp Ant Hill. And there were red ants that lived on that hill. And the red ants would climb up our shorts. They would bite. They would sting. Oh, it was horrible. It was horrible. So when you showered, you see the little ants on the floor of the shower.
Oh my God. Red ants are an absolute nightmare. If you don't live anywhere where, or you've never been anywhere where there's red ants, you're very lucky. They leave little sores all over your body. It stings. It burns. It is a absolute nightmare. So I can just imagine you can't even react to that while you're at boot camp, just trying to make it through. So I can just imagine how ate up all of you were.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Have you been able to maintain any connection with your boot camp sisters?
I have one friend, and I went in 1987. She is my son's godmother, and we've maintained contact all of those years. I'm her oldest son's godmother, and he just joined the Army about 2 years ago, and he is in Germany. Well, he was in Germany. I think then they sent him to Poland. But that one person.
I mean, it was a different time then. So it was a little bit hard. We didn't have the technology that they have today. Like email was just coming out and stuff like that. So it was hard to keep in touch. I was unable to keep in touch with any of my boot camp sisters. And I am forever like, if you are at Naval Training Command, Great Lakes in November of 1994, and you were in Company 908, hit me up. I'm trying to interview. I'm trying to catch up. especially Sunny Woolsey, because she saved my military career. But I'm so grateful to, I remember how sad I felt. Like, boot camp was tough, you know, easier if you were in a 900 company back then, but in an integrated company, because half of our company was guys and it was a new program. I think we were one of the first four. I could be wrong, but it was early in that program. And so we didn't have a brother company, but our company was made up of men and women. And they had the barracks, the open bay barracks just below us in our house. So yeah, it was crazy. But it was wintertime and it was definitely a smart decision to go to boot camp right before Thanksgiving. I went in on November 19th, 1994. And it was very, very smart because it felt like boot camp flew by and there was a lot of downtime because of the holidays. And when it was over, I was too sad. And I felt really conflicted about that. Yeah, I remember that very well. But that was the end of Desert Storm, right? So they were starting to pull people back. And, you know, I made it in just, I'm considered a combat veteran because I went in right at the end of Desert Storm. Mm-hmm. But Desert Storm was really, they were bringing everybody home by then, by the time I actually went to boot camp. So yeah, but that's my era.
And the difference between your story and my story is that I arrived in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia on Christmas morning, 1990. I stepped out of a C5, C4, whatever they were, right into the sand on Christmas morning. It was unbelievable. Unbelievable. And we were there until July. So I saw all of the, you know, we were targeted for Scud launches around the clock. And that's where my PTSD comes in, because I'm just jumping ahead of you. I'm just taking it.
It's okay, because it's cute. I want to know, but was that your first duty station? That's my only question. Or
no, in terms of active duty, I would say yes. You know, I did basic training Fort Jackson. I did advanced training in Fort Harrison, Indiana. And then I did the reserves. I was in college and doing drills for years. And then my unit was activated during Desert Storm. I was assigned to a military police headquarters company. So we were responsible for the oversight of all of the prisoner of war camps.
Oh my goodness.
Yes. So we were very busy round the clock. Around the clock.
And that's the command. You stepped on the sand on Christmas morning.
Yes. Yes. The 800th Military Police Brigade out of Uniondale, New York. Yes.
Okay. So years in college, just being a reservist, which is, you know, 2 weekends a year, right? Or 2 weeks a year. And, how many weekends a month do you do? Like a 1 weekend a month or something like that?
I think 1 weekend a month we did.
And we 2 weeks drills out of the year?
And then 2 weeks out of the year, we did AT training, you know.
Yeah. Okay. I thought I remembered that correctly. Yes. And so then you go through that, and then that's quite a different life, because that's essentially like being a civilian.
Right.
And then, so you finish college, you're a college student, you're living your best college life. And then it's sort of like a weekend warrior for the military, right? But a lot of benefits to that though, right? And then you get activated and you go to Saudi Arabia, like clear across the world.
Yes.
And Christmas Day, what was that transition like for you? Was there a culture shock, or do you feel like being in the reserves prepared you for that to be activated?
No, I wasn't prepared for it. And they actually activated us in early December, and we spent a couple of weeks in Fort Meade, Maryland, preparing. They tried to prepare us for the culture change that we were about to experience. We learned a little bit of Arabic in terms of recognizing numbers. They tried to prepare us for gas attacks, anthrax. It was unbelievable, because, you know, that was when I realized that I joined the Army and this could be life and death. This could absolutely be life and death. So when we actually arrived, there was silence amongst all of us. And there were about 30 of us on the plane. I think we had two trucks on the plane with us. And everybody was scared. We were scared. That's the bottom line. We were scared. We did not know what to expect. You know, they told us about scorpions. They told us about children who could be armed with bombs, women who could be armed with bombs, you know. Just didn't know what to expect.
So that is really heavy. And I love how honest you are about being afraid, because it does hit you. It's real. I remember that we started doing, so this was before 9/11, right? And they had made Great Lakes the only boot camp, like the only training command. And that's where all the C schools are. So that's the whole training center, or most of them. But that's where the only boot camp was, right? Okay. There's a lot of C schools, A schools and C schools there at Great Lakes as well, right? So I want to say it must have been 1997 that we got put on threat condition alpha, right? Something was brewing. We were aware of that. Mm-hmm. And it was a training command in Palm Springs. I went to a training called Fleet Hospital Training. Mm. I went to two of them. And it was just before this that they had started, they took us all into Ross Auditorium in shifts, and they had made us watch this movie about anthrax, some propaganda, right? About anthrax. And I thought, oh my God, am I going to have to be a conscientious objector? Like, what am I? Like, I don't want to take that. Right.
Yeah.
So, and ironically, I did interview Jennifer Marshall. She is an actress from Hollywood. You might recognize her from Stranger Things. And she was on a show called, she is on a show called Mysteries Decoded. And she left the military. She had to be medically discharged because of the anthrax vaccine. And how sick it made her, right? Wow. So I guess my intuition was on point with that. I want to say that. And then the part about fear is I realized that it was a life or death situation in that Fleet Hospital training, because it was super realistic. I mean, they were really preparing us. I mean, we were in a tent city, right? The whole situation. And they were dropping like mock bombs on us. And they had like Arabic playing 24 hours a day over a loudspeaker. Wow. I mean, it was an intense training, and we would have classes part of the day. And then the rest of the day that we were doing wartime drills. And that is when it became real for me. Part of my job was to, and I was a hospital corpsman, but I worked in the pharmacy while I was in. So like the pharmacy techs in the military are equivalent to pharmacists, right? So basically my job was as a pharmacist. We had all the same privileges. And over there, I supported the dental clinic, ironically. But in between, like my side job was to go to the helicopters and help retrieve the sick and injured. I would have to like, and it was all a simulation, but we had to go through the gas chamber and we had to do all this stuff. And that was like probably my third or fourth time going through the gas chamber. I went through that thing a lot. I'm pretty sure it messed me up somehow, but I remember laying in my rack and feeling like this might be a simulation, but they're preparing us for something that's going to be real.
Yes.
And I may have to kill somebody, and I may have to do things that I don't really want to do, you know? Yeah. And it really hit me, and I was really, really scared and just thankful that it was a simulation. So I can just imagine being in that environment for real, what that would have felt like and been like for you. And I remember I did another interview with Taniki Richards. I hope I pronounced her name right. It's been a minute. And I think it was in one of my earlier seasons, 4 or 5. And she was in the Marines, and she talked about going on a night mission, and it got real. And she passed out from the fear. And she carried that as shame as a Marine, but they shouldn't have even been on the mission. If I can recall the story correctly, I have so many stories I've heard. And so, but the fear, like that's an understanding. We are only human and we are to perform in a high stress environment where we are afraid, but perform to the best of our ability. That's the job. To go back to your point about PTSD, I believe that the way that that whole situation impacts your nervous system is what causes the PTSD. It's like that having to perform while incredibly afraid and stressed.
Yes.
And with all of those, you know, just missiles and like now they got drones and like all of the stuff that you have to like be on the alert for, but also still perform your job to the best of your ability. So
absolutely.
I mean, I just feel what you're saying.
Yeah. When a Scud was launched, there was someone who would ride around in a Humvee with a speaker with some sort of horn, and you would hear the air raid siren going off. But he would be on the horn telling us what MOP level we needed to go to. And for those who don't know what MOP is, I don't know what the full name of the, you know, of MOP, M-O-P-P, but it was to get donned in the uniform that would protect us from gas attacks. So it was the gas mask, it was the jacket, it was the pants, and it was the booties. And you had less than a minute to gear up. And, you know, I carry that with me. I carry it with me now because I'm a New Yorker and I came back to New York. So hearing sirens, it still bothers me. And like my sister lives on Long Island, which isn't too far from me. But the firehouses, they have that same type of horn. And to hear that, it just rattles my insides. Loud noises. Now you have guys that do something to their mufflers and it has this backfiring noise. And when that goes off, it absolutely throws me. And Desert Storm was over 30 years ago. So for me to still carry this within me, that says a lot. That says a lot. It has really impacted my life in many ways.
I can just imagine. I mean, I didn't even... fireworks and loud noises, right? I can understand that. It bothers me. I'm jumpy.
Yes.
I'm so jumpy. And I wasn't there with actual missiles going off, but the training was so intense. And I think with the underlying thought of I'm preparing to do this, like they're not just training me for general purposes. Like I'm preparing to do this. I happened to get out before I had to do that. So I was fortunate enough in some ways to have come in at the end of Desert Storm and then served my active service during peacetime. And I got out right after 9/11 of my reserve time.
Wow.
So, I mean, I just narrowly missed any action, really. But I mean, part of me for a long time wished I had gone and didn't feel like a true veteran because I didn't. And it took me a long time to recognize the fact, and I share this with female veterans all the time whenever I run into them and this comes up, is that that doesn't matter, that you're a veteran. You signed on the dotted line, you took that oath, and you dedicated your life. You became property of the United States government, you know, and it's a big deal. So there's absolutely no shame in it. But the effects of being in that environment and to hear you say it's 30 years later and it's still, and I feel it because on the 4th of July, I check on my people.
Yes. I have to correct myself. Something just came to mind. You asked me if I am in contact with any of my, I call them sister veterans, any of my sister veterans from basic training. And yes, I am. Not only am I in touch with my son's godmother, but I reconnected on Facebook with a young lady who we were both from Long Island, and they were flying us from whatever airport here in New York down to Fort Jackson. And we met. And this was the first time that she had ever flown anywhere. And she was so scared. And I held her hand. And I had forgotten all about that. But her name is Janine. And we reconnected a couple of years ago. And she's just, she, you know, when you said that there are some women that don't believe that they are veterans, mm-hmm. because she didn't see combat, because she was never activated during a non-peacetime situation, she does not believe that she's a veteran. And I tell her, you raised your hand. You took that oath. You put that uniform on. You went through basic training in AIT. You served your time, even though you were in the reserves. You are a veteran of the Army.
True story. Okay. Yes. Yeah, shout out to Janine. I feel you, girl. And you are a veteran. Okay. We served. All right. Yes. All right. We did it. We gave up our basic human rights to become property.
Right.
United States government. A lot of people don't know what that feels like, but we do.
Absolutely.
And it matters. Everybody played a part, and every part matters and serves this country. And it doesn't matter. You know what I actually think now? I think that I'm privileged, privileged to have served during peacetime. I was lucky. So I reframed that, right? I reframed it, and hopefully she can reframe it too.
Yes.
But that's a beautiful story. You know, I love that. I was blessed to come in contact with so many amazing people. A lot of them I'm still in touch with, even if it's just on Facebook. And that is the beauty of being a veteran. And I have a similar situation with my private school that I went to before I left to the military. And I happened actually to have coffee with a fellow student from my private school who's an Army veteran. We have not seen each other in 29 years.
Wow.
And today we met and had a coffee and a great, wonderful conversation. And he lives like, I don't know, an hour and a half from me, but we're both out here on the West Coast. We went to school on the East Coast. I'm from the East Coast. And it was amazing. And that's the kind of family you get when you are in the military. Even though he was Army and he served after me and he did his 20 years and retired, it's still military.
Right.
It's family. And it's an even more, I might be biased, but it's an even more special bond when it's veteran sisters.
Yes, so it is.
That's amazing. Is. So what happened at this duty station? Like, what was, I guess, your greatest joy of being there, of Saudi Arabia? Like, what was the best part of being stationed there, despite what was going on?
Meeting so many people from not only the United States, all over, but meeting people from other countries. You know, I met people from Africa. I met people from London. It was so unbelievable. And the funny thing is that we were stationed in Khobar Towers. And when people heard that there was a New York unit in that complex, people would come and just, you know, they wanted to be a part of what we were doing, which was not much of anything. We had a basketball court, a makeshift basketball court outside of it was like an apartment complex. But people would stop and visit, and they wanted to hang out with us. And, you know, I made so many friends, most of them male. And we kept in touch, you know, like by way of correspondence for a little while. And then that just kind of faded. And that makes me sad. And I actually have gone on Facebook to try to search for some of them because they were so kind to me. You know, they took me on as a little sister, and it's just so sad that, you know, those relationships didn't continue to live on.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I lost a lot of really great people along the way, but I've retained some awesome ones. And I, like you, I was lucky. I had a great group of guy friends that protected me from a lot of things that could have gone wrong. Right. And I am just grateful to them to this day, because I hear all the stories on this podcast and some of them are not so good. Yeah. A lot of them, in fact, far too many. And I was protected. I wasn't necessarily protected from poor leadership, but I was protected from a lot of the other stuff. And I'm just grateful to them, you know?
Yeah.
Just grateful.
Yeah. So I am in touch with one sister that I met during Saudi Arabia, during Desert Storm. She was like my best friend there. And we had a falling out. I don't even remember what it was about, but I was fighting. I got injured when we were leaving Desert Storm. We were packing up to leave the country. We were packing up all of our unit equipment, and they had us doing things like in a train. You pass it to me, I pass it to, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. And my knee snapped and my body kind of shifted. And they actually had to carry me back to where we were staying. I didn't know it at the time, but I had torn my meniscus. I came home in July of 91. And in November, I had my first surgery. And my knee has never been the same. I've had two surgeries on my left knee. I have no cartilage between my bones. And it's just bone on bone. It just grinds. And the military fought me. They did not want to compensate me because they sent me the sick call that following day and it wasn't documented because they said to me, you're getting ready to go home. So we're going to give you a Tylenol and an ACE bandage. And when you get home, you make sure you go see a doctor. So it wasn't documented. But I say all of that to bring you back to the young lady that was my best friend. I found her on Facebook. And I told her, you know, how happy I was just to see her again. And I told her how I had been fighting for over 30 years for compensation for my injury. And I said, you were there. You saw what happened. You saw how they had to carry me back. You saw how I struggled, you know, once we came home. I said, I just need you to write a statement because I'm filing a claim and now I have somebody to substantiate what I went through. And because of her statement, I was determined to be service connected.
Wow.
After all of that time.
That is an incredible story in and of itself.
Mm. Yes.
I do know something about fighting the government. I do know how they do you. And I've helped a lot of people since I left the military actually file for their compensation before it was on the computer.
Back in the day. Yes, ma'am.
So yes. When it was a lot of paperwork, right?
Yes.
I used to always insist people file. And I still do. I'm like, you served. It's, you know, your basic needs should never go unmet.
Right.
If you served in the United States military, I don't care. I still don't think they do enough for veterans. And I'm sure that I've done one of my solo cast rants, one of my solo episodes that I call my rants on here. And I'm sure in there I've mentioned, I think it was one of the Veterans Day episode, how salty I am that more people don't offer a veterans discount every day. By the way,
yes.
Every company in this country should be ashamed that they don't do more for veterans, period. Every airline should be ashamed that they do not allow veterans to board that plane early. There's something you can do. And every single company or business in this country should be at minimum offering a veterans discount every single day of the year.
I agree.
Okay, that is like my soapbox. I could go on and on. But and it extends to homelessness and everything else and the medical care and everything that again, I will say when it comes to political theater, we're useful. Mm-hmm. You know, don't offend the veteran community, right? Now you said this or you did that. Now you're offending veterans, right? How come it took you 30 years to get you care so much about veterans? Don't get me started. It took me, it's been about 21 years of me fighting. I still got one little case to go before the board. And I've been in front of the board 3 times. And every time I go in front of the board, I win and I fight the case myself.
Wow.
So I get it. I completely understand because my illnesses are invisible.
Yes.
PTSD is an invisible illness, but I also live with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia. Yes. And I do have some various other, I hurt my shoulder when I was in, mm-hmm. I have migraines. I have a lot of illnesses that I deal with on a regular basis, which is why I do a podcast and I work for myself. I don't work for anybody else because I find, and maybe a lot of people may find, that they don't care. They want you to go to that 9-to-5 and they want you to mm-hmm. do that work. They don't care that you're a disabled veteran, which they should. Okay. Nope. They should. So I'm going to step off my soapbox, but that is my tirade, my rant about how veterans do not get. I mean, yes, we have the home loan and yes, we could, there should be more. I don't care. Mm-hmm. It's not enough. That was World War II times. Come on.
Yeah.
What else can you do? We just fought wars for 20 some years. There's so many veterans out here struggling in these streets. What else can you do? What else you got?
Yep.
You know, that's just how I feel about it. So I promise I'm off my soapbox now. I'm going to return.
Don't climb off of it just yet. I'm also part of an organization called Woven. The Women Veterans Network.
I am for them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I am a national trainer for Woven. And I met another national trainer by the name of April. And I share with her, how I had struggled in terms of trying to substantiate the compensation part of my life. So she put me in contact with a gentleman who is a former Army man himself. His name is Jamal Childs. And Jamal is absolutely incredible. Jamal broke down everything that is wrong with me from head to toe. And he had me put in a claim. I think I had 19 conditions when I filed. I am proud to say that we filed in February, and I just got a decision yesterday. I happened to look on the app. I am 100% total and permanently disabled.
Congratulations.
Applause.
I'm clapping, girl. I am so happy for you because that is a mission. I'm sitting at 90 right now, but because of I'm unemployable technically, then I have the rate of 100%, but really they don't want to give me that 100% total disability, but I'm still fighting. So I'm so happy for you that I get to celebrate with you right now.
Thank you.
Because I know that was a mission. It's funny. Yes. I always say that they prepared us to be fighters and now we got to fight them.
Yes.
Right. That's what I always say. Now I got to fight them. I've been fighting them for years. Kia versus the United States government. Yes. And Detrell too. So congratulations on your win.
Thank you.
It is long overdue and much deserved. And I like to encourage everyone to go out and if you're living with a disability that's service connected and you have not filed any sort of claim and pension, you should be doing that. It's crucial. It's your right because you may not think it matters now, but wait until you're 65.
Right.
Every bit is going to help while you're living with these illnesses or injuries. And especially my brothers and sisters, but especially my sisters that listen to this. There are a few men, surprisingly, but it's really important that you do this for yourself, especially if you live with an invisible illness like PTSD.
Yes.
You know, it is, you deserve to be compensated for the fact that you are never going to be the same again. That's just my opinion, my humble opinion.
Not at all. Yes. I so agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah. So we got to be out here doing the good fight and supporting our sisters out here that are trying to do their
best. Keep it together.
Trying to do their best, whatever that is for you. So I want to ask you, so you got injured and that's why you left Saudi Arabia there. So that was when your transition started happening. You didn't serve any other commands?
No, I was done at that point.
So I guess my next question would be, what was the transition out for you like? Like, so you were looking at a surgery, you had a lot of medical issues on top, because I talked to a lot of female veterans, right, on and off of this program, and almost all of them, I probably can count on one hand how many told me their transition out was easy.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Or they felt prepared, you know, for their transition out. There's so few that I've spoken to. So what was the transition out for you on knowing that you had a surgery coming up and that you had a medical issue?
Well, I didn't know that my knee was damaged as badly as it was. Mm. So I thought I would just go home and get back to life. Little did I know that my life would never be the same. I didn't want to have any attachment to the VA hospitals or anything. So I went to my private physician for referrals to orthopedic specialists. My surgery was done at a private hospital. I was just totally turned off of anything having to do with the Army, with the VA, with anything. And that went on for years, especially after I saw how they treated my injury. So I was very bitter. I was extremely bitter. I met a guy who had also been stationed in Saudi Arabia. And he told me, he said, Detroit, you've got to file for benefits. They owe you. They owe you. He said, you have to come with me to the VA hospital. You know, I went begrudgingly. And when I filed for my first claim, I was denied. I was denied twice. And I was really, I was frustrated. But when I came home, I found that I couldn't relate to my family. I isolated. The 4th of July was horrific for me. I was somebody totally different than when I had gone in. I looked for help. I tried to find help. I said, well, maybe I can find a support group at the VA. But sadly, the people in the group, they didn't look like me. They didn't sound like me. Their experiences were not mine. Most of them were older Vietnam veterans. They didn't treat me as though they wanted me there. You know, my combat situation was nothing like theirs. And I wasn't a true veteran to them. And it was sad. I was very depressed, very depressed.
Wow, that is incredibly disheartening. And I've heard a couple of instances like this. I remember a story from Avow magazine, the founders of Avow magazine, and they joined a biker group for motorcycles. Mm-hmm. And they were treated like that, you know? But for me, I have never had that it's experience, although I hear that it happens, you know? So that's so heartbreaking to me that fellow veterans would treat you different.
Like I didn't belong.
That makes me really sad. How did you get through that? You are already feeling really low, like, and then that happens. Did you completely turn away from anything to do with veterans and military and all of that?
Yep.
I hear that a lot too.
I absolutely did. I think it took a while for me to even identify as a veteran. My son was born a year after I came back. And he still tells me to this day, every time he listens to an interview or he hears me talk about my experience, he always says to me, why haven't you shared this with me? You don't talk about, you know, and I really want to know more, mommy. You know, it's very challenging to discuss. Very challenging.
You know, it makes me feel so sad because it sounds like, unless I just didn't get the full story, it sounds like you had a pretty good time in Saudi. And then just at the end, you got hurt. And it just, that one thing, like, destroyed your whole, I mean, aside of it being very dangerous and it creating PTSD, that's one, but that's par for the course of being in a war zone, right? Yeah. But that injury and how you were treated afterwards, not necessarily by on active duty, but by the veteran side. And I've definitely heard that too, a lot, where, you know, these veteran hospitals, they can mistreat people.
Right.
They can let vets slip through the cracks. I mean, I remember back some years ago where they had discovered in Phoenix that they were messing around with people's records and appointments and veterans were dying. You're not going to convince me that that's the only time and place that happened. And I've had probably a handful of guests from the different seasons. That's why you got to listen to them all. That have had experiences with the VA healthcare system that are nightmarish.
Right.
Mine hasn't been that great. You know, it's been good and bad, but it, you know, it should have been just all good. Right. So, I mean, the care that we receive as veterans can be questionable. And so I will share with you. So I like to go to therapy because of my experiences in the military and after. And out here, I have gone to the vet center and I was having a rough moment. Okay. And I would like to go to the vet center, and it's always been a place where I could go. And 9 out of 10 times, I'll say 8 out of 10 times, I felt very supported and had a lot of help. But this time has been very different. I actually had to ask for a different counselor, and then I'm going to have to let the new one go too. You know what I mean? Like, and I remember I went through primary care to seek some support. And because the backstory on that is my boyfriend went to the war in Ukraine and I was freaking out. I was triggered. Wow. Triggered. And so I went to go get some support because I didn't have experience with my spouse was in the military, my first one, but we served during peacetime. So I went to go have some support, and all of my friends and stuff that had partners that had served during wartime, it just wasn't good. So for the most part. So I went to go get some support, and I was also having some other rough scenarios going on in my life at the same time. And it felt like overwhelming. Right. So I went to primary care at the VA to get some therapy. Okay. And I encourage everybody, go get you some therapy. Okay.
That's right.
Do some therapy. Okay. And you don't have to do it alone. There is no shame in it. Please, let's remove the stigma. Your mental health is important. There's no shame in it. If you need to get on meds for a while, I've done that too. Mm-hmm. For anxiety and depression surrounding my illnesses stemming from the military. Okay. That's all in my medical record. So. That being said, I thank God for Elena. Shout out to Elena. I don't know if you'll ever hear this, but Elena, thank you so much. Elena happened to get me. She just, luck of the draw, had to meet with me to figure out where I needed to be shuffled along to, right? And Elena saw my distress and my struggle and my frustration and my feeling unsupported. And I was popping off. Okay. I was popping off about how the system, because they didn't have anything for me that could help me in the way I knew exactly how I needed to be helped. Mm-hmm. I'd received it before at the vet center, but my counselor was no longer there. So I knew what I was looking for, but they had nothing for me. Because the way that they have changed the system is different. And it's kind of meant to like isolate something, like, for example, PTSD. And you do these kind of almost like courses that help you learn coping skills, and then they push you along. I mean, that is not what I was looking for at all. I was looking for therapy. Okay. Yes. And they don't offer it, right? Not in the way you think, right? And this is our VA healthcare system, our tax dollars at work, honey. So Elena helped me, and she found a way to help me by going above and beyond. And Elena is a resident.
Wow.
And she actually helped me get through a really tough moment in my life, not necessarily because she's not really allowed to give me therapy, but because she was willing, because she saw me, she saw my pain, she saw that I was on the edge, she saw that I was about to go off the edge, okay? And she helped me, she saw me, she heard me, and she went the extra mile to get me the support that I need, where I need it.
That's beautiful.
And so it's not all bad.
Right.
But so often that's not the case, right? And I actually said to her, I said, this is why people take their lives.
Right.
I said, because they're right on the edge and they come looking for help and all the doors get shut in their faces.
Yep.
And then they're already there. They're already on the edge. You just go over, you know.
Well, my confidence, I started therapy during the pandemic. We were locked in place. New York had shut down. And I was working from home. And it was too much for me. And that's when I reached out to the VA. And I said, I need to be assigned to a therapist. I just felt overwhelmed. PTSD was in full swing. And they actually connected me with someone who really, her compassion, her care, her willingness to just work with me, to listen to me, to hear me out, to help me find a way to cope. She was great. And then, you know, they asked me if I wanted to pursue primary care through the VA. And because I work in another city from where it is, another borough, excuse me, this is New York, another borough, than where I live, I decided to seek primary care in the borough where I work because it would be closer for me to get there as opposed to the next VA hospital, which is a distant, traffic is horrendous, just a mess. But I couldn't continue to see that therapist because she was connected to a different VA hospital. So they connected me to somebody where my primary care physician is. And the connection was just not there. It wasn't there. It just didn't work. So they reassigned me to the person who was actually running the department. And he worked with me doing CBT. He was phenomenal. We worked so well together, and then he dropped the bomb. He was now taking on a new position at that VA hospital where I said I would not travel to, and that was it. That was it. So now, you know, I still have my primary care. I have my psychiatrist in the VA hospital near where I work, and I just told my psychiatrist this morning, I said, I need to find a therapist. I can feel it in myself that I need to reconnect. I need to realign. I need to recalibrate some things that is, you know, just going on with me internally. And I'm not afraid to say so.
I love that you said that, you know, because it's about that vulnerable share today. apparently. But I mean, it's real talk because I know that we all go through it. 99% of the people, more than likely, who listen to this podcast can relate exactly to what we both said.
Right.
For different reasons. mm-hmm. a lot of the things that we said. So I definitely understand where you're coming from. And it's hard, but I think it's really important to note that you may not always like your therapist. You may not always connect with the right person straight away, but keep looking. Keep mm-hmm. trying, because there are people out there that you will mesh with, you will connect with, you will align with, and they can help you. They can help you, you know, wherever you are in your process, you know. And I love that you said you can feel it in yourself, because that self-awareness is really key. It's just like I did. I knew as soon as my guy left for that war that I wasn't going to make it. I was going to come unglued. Okay. And I already had a lot of other things happening in my life too, but that was the icing on the cake. That was the straw that broke the camel's back, if you will.
Right.
Like,
yeah,
I knew my limit of what I could handle.
Wow.
And so I saw it. Actually, what happened too, I'll tell you, since we're vulnerable sharing, is I knew that I was going to struggle with him gone and him going in the trenches and stuff like that. And I knew what I was going to need, right? And I went looking for it and I couldn't find it. And I was looking for it because I knew that we would break up if I didn't find it. And we broke up.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I couldn't handle it. And he couldn't handle me not handling it. But I knew that's what was going to happen. I knew. And so I tried to seek support, but I didn't get the support I needed. So that's what happened, right? And it took me, that was in March. I did not get the support I needed until the end of August. But mm-hmm. I tried.
Yeah.
You know, so it's you have to know, you know, and it took me that time, but I didn't give up because I needed the support. Because I was on the edge. I had too many things going on in my life. I had surgery. I was in pain. I had quite a cancer scare. I had a lot of things happening at all at one time. And mentally and emotionally, it was a moment, and I've had several since I left the military, where I needed some additional support. And it took me some time to find it. And you have to advocate for yourself. You know, because nobody's going to advocate for you.
Nope.
You have to advocate for yourself. And so that's why I left the first girl, because I just felt like she didn't give a shit, to be honest with you. Like, and then the new girl that I have is really sweet and really nice. But I think that they might be too young to really understand me.
Yes.
Like, I mean, not to be ageist, but... You know what I mean? Like, it is what it is. You know? So I look young. I'm not young. And I need somebody who is not of such a youthful mentality that what can you offer me when you haven't lived much life?
Right.
You know? So
that's real.
You know.
That is real. Yes.
You know, I feel like I'm my own therapist in those sessions. You know, it's like I can go talk to her and I can release things, but there's no support. Like, it's like, okay, thanks for sharing. Shall we book your next appointment? And I'm like,
yes.
There feels like there's something missing from this experience that I actually need, though. You know?
So, right. Yeah.
But I think we do. We have to advocate for ourselves, which is why you have to be willing to keep trying people until you find the right fit. Because when you do, it's life-changing.
Yes. Yes, it is.
It's life-changing. So,
yes, it is.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I want to ask you about United and Sisterhood. And how did you come? So, because my understanding is you kind of went really far away from anything to do with military. You're kind of, and so common too. Like, if I had a dollar for every veteran, male or female, that told me that for like at least 5 years after serving, that they wouldn't even tell anyone they were a veteran. I was one of them, by the way. Oh God, I was so anti-establishment. I went far, like I went really far in another direction. Okay, because I was like, But tell me, like, what brought you back to want to, like, especially with the experience of being, feeling ostracized and unwelcome in a group of veterans? Like, what inspired you? Did you just feel like, I can't find it, so I'm going to create it? Or?
Well, I have 4 college degrees, and I just received an honorary doctorate in June.
I am not mad at you.
Global International Alliance.
Congratulations. So
I am an honorary doctor. But I was in seminary. I was working towards a Master of Divinity. And I had a class where the professor wanted everyone to identify their ministry. And my calling to go into seminary came directly from God. I had been running from this calling for over 20 years. And finally, God sat me down and said, I need you to do more with your life. But this particular class, what the professor gave us as our final assignment was to find somebody who was doing what you thought you should be doing under the heading of ministry. And I said, well, you know, I know someone who's actually working at the VA. She seeks out veterans who have criminal histories, and she reconnects them with the VA. Because a lot of times when somebody encounters the criminal justice arena, they feel like they lose their veteran status, which is not true. But anyway, I had to interview her. And through the conversation with her, I realized that I was not walking in my purpose. I was not doing what I knew God had laid inside of me to do for female veterans. And what that was to provide them with what I did not have when I came home from combat. The support groups that I told you that I encountered, where there were no females, there were only men. They didn't accept me. They made me feel ostracized. It was just horrible. And from there, I started to think and put some groundwork into establishing a nonprofit. And that nonprofit is United in Sisterhood. It is a full-fledged 501c3. During the pandemic, well, before the pandemic, I had a small group of women. We would meet once a month at a church in Jamaica, Queens. And then the pandemic hit. And I was like, I've got to do something. I've got to do something to continue my mission. So I established a group on Facebook. And, you know, it was just really small at first. And I was like, what do I do with this? You know, because I know what I went through. I know what I wanted. And I wanted the women to feel the same way. So I started looking at what was on Facebook in terms of organizations or groups for female veterans. And everything was just different. Some were inactive, some were kind of corny, some were doing like silly things just to make, you know, make light of the pandemic and, you know, making people feel comfortable. But I established United in Sisterhood, and I started reaching out to veterans that I crossed paths with on Facebook. And one person would tell another one, and another would tell another one. And then I started reaching females who were bringing 20 people in, who were bringing 30 people in. So I went from a group of maybe 5. I now have 313 women across the country. Some are inactive. But what I see is that when I post something of interest, I see the number of people that actually look at it and the number of people that actually respond. So during the pandemic, we were meeting once a month. We would kind of just come together to check in to make sure everybody was doing well. I stopped over the summer because, you know, once the pandemic was kind of subsiding, because I still don't think it's really over. I'm hoping that we don't go back into it over the cold weather month. But people started traveling. People started reconnecting with family. And they didn't really have time to sit online like they did prior. but I am going to reintroduce our monthly group meetings because they've asked me for it. And I want to bring people like you who are actually doing things to connect female veterans in a positive way. Some of the things that we do, I introduce a fairy dust sprinkling once a month where I connect two women together and they either look at what somebody's favorite things are and they'll send them a package. And that started during the pandemic. It was nice to receive something happy, something that would make you smile, make you feel joyful. And that has continued. The women really love it. They love it. When I kind of slack off, they ask me, you know, well, what are we doing this month? You know, are you going to do it? And then I also, someone asked me to introduce buddy pairs, you know, so that women could be paired up. They could check in on one another and they can make sure everybody is okay. But since the inception in 2019, we've done Bible study groups. I have a female in the group who owns a farm in Georgia, I think she has 92 or 96 acres, and she had 15 horses. I'm not sure what she has now, but I actually had an opportunity to go down to Georgia and spend a few days on her farm working with horses. I love horses. And we actually talked about trying to set up a retreat for some of the women. So I am seeking a grant writer so that I can get some funding and try to do something to absorb the costs, because a lot of the women in the group are located in Texas, but they're everywhere. I have women in New England, women in Virginia. I have a woman in Colorado. They're everywhere. They're everywhere. But I want to be able to bring us together. That's my ultimate goal, to bring us together. And then the rest I'm going to save for when I retire so that I can fully focus on watching United in Sisterhood flourish to what it was intended to do.
I love that. That is amazing.
Thank you.
I'm glad to support and share. So we can just go to Facebook and find the group and join?
It's a private group. I have three questions that anyone looking to join must answer. It asks, are you a female? Because I've had some men try to join, trying to look for women. It asks you what your branch of service is. And it asks you if you'll adhere to the rules of the group, which are to be respectful, not to solicit for funding for your own private organization, which I have had some people come in and try to do. And once you submit those answers to those questions, I'll approve you and you come on in. You come in, we welcome you. I ask you to introduce yourself, tell people who you are, what your branch of service was, where you're located, and anything that you may want to share with us. Real simple.
That is wonderful. I love that. I'm going to join.
Yay.
I'm going to join. I mean, this is really incredible. And I have loved hearing everything that you have been through, and particularly your fight with the United States government to have your service connection realized. Because I think there's a lot of people out here in that fight, ready to start that fight, you know, and want to know more about what that's like, you know. And I think we covered a lot of really awesome topics that I didn't expect to cover. Which is great.
I thank you for sharing with me.
Thank you so much. This is a conversation with two veteran sisters, right? This is not just an interview.
Yes.
This is us getting it out. I think I feel better when I connect with female veterans and I get to do this. Is my way of giving back and supporting the female veteran community as well. And I just love connecting with my veteran sisters. And speaking of veteran sisters, what advice do you have for your veteran sisters coming up behind you?
What I would advise them to do is to, one, connect with the VA. As staunchly opposed as I was 30 years ago, I am a big proponent of VA care. I have some of the best doctors you can imagine, from my primary to my rheumatologist, to my podiatrist, to my psychiatrist, just wonderful, wonderful people. So that's the first thing. The second thing that I would definitely encourage my sister veterans to do is to seek out organizations where they can find support and encouragement. Organizations like United in Sisterhood and some others, you know, in your local area, there may be some. Some you may only find online, you know, but find something where you can feel supported and encouraged and where you'll actually know that you're not alone.
Some good advice that is really important, you know, seek support. You're not
yes.
alone.
You're yes. not
alone. You're not. We're out here.
So, yes.
So obviously we can find you on Facebook. Are there any other places we should look so that we can support you?
Yes, ma'am. I just had my website revamped. It is www.unitedinsisterhood.org. The only piece of that I'm still working on, I'm building my resource page. So if anybody has resources that they would like for me to consider to list on the page, I absolutely invite you to contact me. My email address is detrell, D-E-T-R-E-L, at unitedinsisterhood.org.
Perfect. And well, if you are not new to this podcast, you know that I put all of this in the description of the episode or the show notes, as I call them. And so it's there for you to find it very easily. And so you can support Detrell and everything that she's doing for female veterans, as we all should be supporting people who are doing things for female veterans. So it will be there for you. And Detrell, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on the Female Veterans Podcast. It has been such a pleasure to connect with you and to share with you and to have these moments together.
You as well. I think that what you're doing is absolutely wonderful. It's a tremendous blessing, and you are an asset to female veterans across the country. Please don't stop.
Not going anywhere anytime soon. You honor me. Thank you so much. And with that, we're going to wrap it up. So thank you so much for coming on this journey with me and listening and supporting this podcast as I continue it and continue to grow it. I am now on YouTube in audio form only, but I think that what I'm going to do is do every now and again, either a live or a video episode of the podcast just for the YouTube channel. Not all the time, but every now and again. And I'm thinking of doing like some special episodes. Maybe I'll interview some women who served in Afghanistan and Iraq and do some video episodes, just like a mini series or a limited series, I guess they call it, and maybe do them on YouTube. So if you like that idea, definitely let me know. You can go to thefemaleveteranspodcast.com and put it in the contact form. You can also go there if you want to be a guest on the podcast. There is a wait list right now, just to let you know. So bear with me. If you've given me your information to be on the show, I will reach out to you. But please go subscribe to the YouTube channel. It costs nothing and it means everything to me. And share and like and comment. That's really important too for these algorithms, as they say. And well, I love you guys. And I'll talk to you next time.